web at www.zentertainment.org. My name is Joe Davidson. Thank you so much for joining me. Today, my guest on the show is Kelly Turner. She's the author of a new book called Radical Remission, The 9 Key Factors That Can Make a Real Difference. You can find out more at radicalremission.com. Dr. Kelly Turner is a researcher, a lecturer, and consultant in the field of integrative oncology. Her specialized research focus is the radical remission of cancer, which is a remission that occurs either in the absence of conventional medicine or after conventional medicine has failed. You've probably all heard a story like this. A person with advanced cancer tries everything conventional medicine has to offer, including chemo and surgery, but nothing works. She's sent home to die, but 5 years later strolls into her doctor's office, healthy and cancer-free. So why are these stories not on the front page of every newspaper? And even if it happens only once, it's incredible. What Kelly found shocked her. There were over 1,000 cases in print, all quietly published in medical journals. And yet she was working at a major cancer research institution, and this was the first time she had ever heard of one. Today we're going to share some of her research and talk about her new book, Radical Remission. Hi, Kelly. Welcome to the show today.
Hi. Thanks for having me on, Joe.
What is radical remission?
Well, a radical remission is when someone survives cancer against all odds, someone who has a statistically unlikely cancer remission. So, you know, these are people who, when they're given, you know, a 1% chance or a 5% chance, that those are the people I'm talking to, the people who really beat the odds and surprise their doctors. It's known in the medical field as spontaneous remission. So you may have heard that, or your listeners may have heard that, but I don't like that word, mostly because the people that I study don't like that word. spontaneous, I mean, I have nothing against the word, of course,
right.
But the word spontaneous implies that something happened without a cause and quickly. And the people that I've studied now for more than 10 years, I've been doing this for a decade now, and I've done over 200 in-person interviews, and I've analyzed over 1,000 written cases. There are an estimated 100,000 cases out there, but of course I'm only one person, so I can only do so much. But after doing all this research, the people that I study, one of the things they have in common is that they take months, if not years, to heal, and they work really hard. They make radical lifestyle changes. That's why I call it radical remission. So they're not just sitting around and poof, their cancer goes away. They take their health into their own hands and start making change after change after change. And that's why we landed on the term radical remission instead of spontaneous remission. I also interview alternative cancer healers, since, of course, many radical remission survivors go seek these healers out. And one of the healers that I interviewed said, people, when someone is sick, you need to keep making changes until you come across the change that your body, mind, spirit was asking you to make. And I just love that quote.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because it just summarizes everything. You know, so many people, and certainly myself included before I began this research, you know, in American society, we're taught that when we're sick, we need to go get the broken part fixed and then return to life as normal. And what I've learned, what the people that I study believe, is something different. They believe that when you're sick, it's an alarm bell. It's not a broken, you know, a broken part in your body that needs repair. It's an alarm bell that something in your life has caused a breakdown. And therefore, something needs to permanently change in your life in order for the condition to be able to be repaired and be able to stay repaired permanently. So it's this move away from, you know, oh, I've got a broken thing, you know, give me a pill and I'll be fixed. It's moving instead towards something in my life is broken. I need to make a permanent change in my life, and then I will heal.
You have worked with, questioned a lot of oncologists about, you know, what they've seen. And you wrote in the book that every one of them had seen a case of radical remission. Was this surprising to you?
It was, because when I, you know, I started off as just a counselor, a psychotherapist for cancer patients. So I'm not a medical doctor. I'm not giving medical advice in this interview. I always like to say that. But I was working alongside oncologists as part of an integrative team, and I was in charge of the patient's mental and emotional health. But I've since gone back for my PhD in research and learned, how to study things statistically and with trials and that sort of thing. But I was surprised that when I started researching this, the oncologists that I had been working alongside for all those years were like, oh yeah, I had a couple of those kinds of cases. And I'm like, really? and this isn't something you ever wanted to investigate or, mention perhaps, but it isn't something that they necessarily choose to investigate because it baffles them. And it's just human nature that when something confuses you or mystifies you, you don't always know how to begin investigating it. You know, they say, I'm so glad, Kelly, that you looked into this because I've had a case or two like that in my practice and, I didn't know what to do about it. So, yeah.
It's really interesting to me that anybody in medicine these days would see things as so dissected and separate and everything's integrated and integrative and healing involves so many different layers. So to see it in any other way, it surprises me,
Well, you're on the forefront of where things are moving. I'm sure you know that.
Yes. I've actually, the thing I'm working with now is more everything I can find in neuroplasticity research. And there's amazing research in neuroplasticity of how people are healing a wide range of things that otherwise were thought to be fixed and incurable.
And just for your listeners, neuroplasticity means the changeability of the brain. So, before, say 10 years ago, science thought they had the answer, which was that, after about age 5, your brain doesn't make major changes. Well, science has suddenly discovered a new truth, which is that they were wrong, and that the brain continues to change throughout your entire lifespan, and that your behaviors are what stimulate your brain to change as an adult.
One of the things you wrote in your book that I love so much was that in your first research class at UC Berkeley, you said that you learned that it's a researcher's scientific obligation to examine any cases that do not fit into his or her hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
That's good stuff.
it's just good science, really. Uh-huh. I the only criticism I really get from this research are people who say, aren't you going to raise false hope?
Right.
And certainly that's not my intention, and I make that very clear in my book to say that all we know is that these 9 factors are the 9 most common threads of this group, this very unique group of radical survivors. We haven't tested these 9 things in clinical trials yet, so we can't make definitive conclusions. These are hypotheses only. So as soon as I say that and make that very clear, which I do in every interview, then we've erased this possibility of false hope. But what's even worse than false hope is bad science. Mm-hmm. Okay, and it's bad science to be treating people and treating a disease a certain way and then have someone come along and have a totally different experience by using totally different treatments and cure themselves and just simply shrug your shoulders and say, oh, well, I'm happy for you.
That's not acceptable.
That's not acceptable. It's bad science, especially when, if we had cured cancer and some people were doing it one way and some people were curing it another way, then you could maybe say, okay, good for you. But we're not curing cancer. It is not a done deal. Mm-hmm. And so when someone walks into your office and says, hey, remember when you sent me home on hospice? Here I am. Mm-hmm. It is irresponsible to just simply say, great, I'm happy for you. It is scientifically irresponsible. What we are supposed to do as scientists and researchers is to investigate anomalies or investigate outliers. And this particular group of outliers has been ignored for the last 100 years. And that's not okay.
If I was a doctor, the very first thing I would want to know is tell me everything.
Tell me everything.
Tell me everything.
Well, I'm not a doctor, but that was my reaction too. And I think it's most people's reaction.
Yeah, tell me everything.
Tell me everything. And what I found, believe it or not, is that in these 1,000 published cases that are in medical journals, they've been verified. These people were diagnosed officially with cancer. Their before and after scans are in there for your eyes to see. Uh-huh. But guess what? The authors of these articles didn't ask the survivor to tell them everything. It's just a simple medical report. Patient X walked in, had cancer. Here's the before scan. 6 months later, patient X walked back in. No cancer, no hypothesis, end of report. And I would read report after report after report in the medical journals, and I would say, well, what did the patient do? Did anyone ask the patient if they did anything physical, emotional, spiritual? I don't care. You know, like, I want to know, what did they do? Tell me everything. And that is exactly what I did. The kind of research I do is called qualitative research. It's based on anthropology. So when anthropologists come across, you know, a new tribe in the Amazon that no one's ever met before because they've been so secluded, you have to apply anthropological methods to begin understanding this brand new, you know, society, this very, you know, unusual, mysterious tribe of people. And so when you have something like that in medicine, which is this group of people that's very mysterious and inexplicable, the first step of the scientific method is to come up with a hypothesis. You know, why did these people get well? Well, if you don't have a hypothesis, if you don't even have a guess, which is what the problem is with radical remission, doctors simply don't have even the slightest hunch as to why these people got better. You have to go to the very first step of the scientific method, which is to observe. And that's where anthropology comes in. And that's where you don't go in with a hypothesis. You don't go in with questions. You go in with one question, which is, tell me everything. Why do you think you healed? And what's great about that kind of research is that it allows you to hear hypotheses or potential explanations from the people themselves. And that's where my data comes from. It's called grounded theory because it comes from the ground up. The people that I study, these radical remission survivors, did over 75 different things to get well. So they tried a lot of different things. But not everyone did all 75. Mm-hmm. However, everyone that I've studied did all nine of these things. Some of them did eight because some of them didn't do supplements. But they did eight, if not all nine, of these most common factors. So I always like to start with that explanation. They didn't do just one. They did all nine. And these nine most common factors range from physical to emotional to spiritual changes in their life. And the physical ones are radically changing your diet and then taking herbs and supplements. The other seven, believe it or not, are mental, emotional, or spiritual. And those range the gamut from things like releasing suppressed emotions to embracing social support and making sure you have social support, to things like taking control of your healing and having strong reasons for living. The trends of their radical diet change are moving towards eating a lot more fruits and vegetables and moving away from things like meat, wheat, sweets, and dairy. They also made sure, very sure, to buy organic foods whenever possible. And then they also drank a lot of filtered water. So those are the overall trends. Now, some people went raw vegan. Some people, you know, didn't emphasize the raw so much or didn't emphasize the vegan quite as much. It really depended on, you know, people listening to their body and being monitored by, you know, usually an integrative health professional who was, you know, looking at how their cancer markers adapted to their new diet.
Well, that's really the thing. And you even wrote in your book about somebody who was able to tell, you know, based on what he ate, he could see changes when he would go in and do a test. That was very interesting.
Yeah, that's John. John was diagnosed with prostate cancer about, 13, 14 years ago now. And it was pretty advanced at that point. And so his doctors recommended a full prostatectomy, meaning completely surgically removing his entire prostate, which he said, yeah, he said, take it out of me, you know, get this cancer out of me. And so he had his entire prostate removed, and then he had chemo, radiation, and hormone therapy. Mm-hmm. It was really intense and really, you know, had both the short-term and long-term side effects. But it worked, quote-unquote worked, because the cancer went away. But unfortunately, 5 years later, it came back, and it came back very strongly. Now, this was interesting because he no longer even had a prostate. So the fact that his PSA, which is the blood marker for prostate cancer, the fact that that was rising so much meant that he now had metastatic prostate cancer. So the prostate cancer cells had spread to other parts of his body. And his doctor said, well, we got to get you back on chemo. We got to get you back on radiation and maybe the hormone therapy. But it doesn't look good.
Yeah.
And he was really depressed about that. He was, you know, he was at that point dealing with permanent side effects to his urinary and sexual functioning because of the prostate removal. And so he already felt sort of beaten down by this disease. To know that it was back with a vengeance was really hard on him. Mm-hmm. So he went to a bookstore to get a book about how you died. He was, you know, kind of down in the dumps and really preparing for that. But instead, he saw a bunch of books about using nutrition to help with the cancer diagnosis. And he said, he literally said, oh, what the hell?
Right. He had nothing to lose.
Right. What do I have to lose? I guess I'll give it a shot. Mm-hmm. And he's the kind of guy. I love John's personality. He'll jump into anything, sort of cold turkey, whole hog. And so he just jumped right in, and he cold turkey cut out sugar, all sugar, for 2 weeks. And he said it was so hard, but he did it. And then he started to eat a diet, you know, rich in fruits and vegetables. And his mantra is, if I don't cook it, I don't eat it. Like, if he doesn't make it from scratch, he doesn't eat it. And anyway, he has come up with a very particular diet for himself that controls his PSA. And he also does the other eight factors in his book, and stress management is really key for John as well. But he's kind of been his own guinea pig, and he notices, you know, when he drinks red wine and eats red meat, his PSA goes up. Now, that may not be true for all prostate cancer survivors and patients, but for his body, he needs to really, really limit those things.
You know, one of the things that I have seen and heard in a lot of my research is that people do go a lot of into the raw vegan and not just juicing, but, you know, just whole organic foods for a while. And I've also seen some people who then, I've heard stories where they did that for, you know, 3 months of that is very difficult. But maybe, you know, a couple months of that. And then they went actually paleo, which did include a lot of organic meats and grass-fed and wild fish and stuff, but that's also a completely different diet than what most Americans eat. And that one cuts out all grains, all beans, all sugar, all dairy, and so you're basically eating 9 cups of vegetables a day, and then some of these bone broths and things. And that actually I've seen a lot more research on for autoimmune conditions with mm-hmm. Dr. Terry Walls, who has reversed her progressive MS when the Cleveland Clinic could offer nothing more. She healed, and her book is The Walls Protocol. So it's very different to me a little bit with some of the conditions and with people's individual bodies, but there's definitely some things across the board that need to be changed, whatever direction you go.
The meat-grain debate, you know, is something to pay attention to, you know, because for paleo, they say, you know, no grain, no starches, and yes to meat. And, you know, the vegan people say no meat and yes to some whole grains and to some, you know, plant-based.
A lot of beans, right.
Yeah. And again, I think this comes, I'm not a nutritionist, and I'm not a medical doctor, so I can't say which of these diets is better for you. What I can say is that you should keep making changes in your diet until you find the one that works for your cancer or for your health condition. And I will say that the one common thread that I've seen in all of these diets is vegetables.
Yeah, that's
that
true.
Doesn't go away. You know, some people say don't eat so much fruit because of the sugar. Some people say don't eat starches. Some people say don't eat meat. But, you know, the one constant in all of these diets, whether it's paleo or vegan or, you know, the zone diet or whatever you want to say, is vegetables. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you're sick, start with that and then see how your body and see how your numbers do when you add grains and whole grains, of course, and then see how your numbers and your body feels when you add in, you know, meat if you want to go paleo. But the one constant that everyone should be eating lots and lots of is vegetables. And just to follow up, by the way, John just to finish that story.
Yeah.
John has kept his cancer completely in remission now for 6 years,
amazing.
And he has not had to go back on chemo, radiation, or hormone therapy.
Did you notice in some of these stories, and by the way, I do want to clarify that any of you listening have chosen or are choosing to do chemo or anything conventional, there's nothing that Kelly or myself is saying here that is in any way placing any judgment on that. So, you know, these are things you can do in addition to, and
exactly.
Some people do in place of. So it's completely your decision. But this book gives you some things to consider.
Absolutely. You know, I say right in my introduction that I personally am not against Western medicine whatsoever. I just happen to study this unique group of survivors who have healed without it. And it's sort of like studying people who run a marathon barefoot, right? Just because someone decides to study those people doesn't mean they're anti-shoes, right? And the researchers who studied those Kenyans who, you know, can run 26 miles barefoot, those researchers wear shoes, right? And no one's accusing them of being anti-shoe. I'm studying this control group because they need to be. To be a good researcher, you need to study anomalies, and I'm being a good researcher.
So just from a research perspective, is there any emotional pattern that you've seen show up that people said to you, this was something that I needed to work on or change? Was there a consistent thread, or was it really, really different for a lot of people?
Well, you know, it's different for everyone. There was certainly... My research did not focus on causes of cancer. It focused on how people heal.
Mm-hmm.
And what I always like to say is, if you crack a teapot and you fix it with glue, it didn't break because of lack of glue.
Mm-hmm.
And that analogy applies to using, you know, 7 of my 9 factors are mental, emotional, spiritual. So when we talk about mental, emotional, and spiritual changes that you can make in order to help your immune system, which then helps your body fight cancer, we're not no one's saying necessarily that it was the lack of those emotional things that necessarily caused your cancer in the first place. We know scientifically that cancer is caused by many different things. So for some people, it's absolutely caused by toxins. They grew up with asbestos, you know, or they grew up with radiation. No one that I research, and certainly myself, we're not in the business of trying to figure out how you got your cancer. What I'm trying to figure out is, once cancer's in your body, how do people get rid of it? How do these people heal it? And a lot of them used mind-body-spirit interventions, and that's all we know. We don't know anything more than that. We know that it's a powerful tool in a healing toolbox that many, many people in this country don't even know is there. They don't know that this tool is in their toolbox. Now, that's all a big preamble to say that certainly some of the people that I researched believed that their high-stress life, or their, you know, long-term holding on to anger at their ex-husband, or the trauma that they went through, you know, when their both parents died 2 years before they got cancer. There are people that I interviewed who said that they believed that those things contributed to their cancer. But certainly across the board, I didn't see any trends as to what causes cancer.
One of the things that I've seen show up in different research, I thought I might have read it in your book, but I wasn't sure, is some of the people had more of a desire to please others or put others first a lot. Did that come up?
You know, that's I'm so glad you brought that up. That's the famous type C personality for cancer. And it was found in one study that made major headlines back in the 80s. And it has since been overturned. It has not been replicated. It's been sort of debunked that if you, you know, constantly please others, you'll get cancer and not please yourself.
I'm glad you're sharing that, because when I talked to Candace Pert, you know, who author of Molecules
yeah.
of Mission, she's since passed away now, but when I talked to her, she said it is such, this is not her exact words, okay, but, you know, she's basically saying it's garbage how the holistic communities try to tell everybody that if you got cancer, it was because of your thoughts. Because one thing she did say is, she said, a lot of the illnesses we're seeing today are from environmental toxins.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I just have to share that one of my pet peeves really is this pink ribbon thing that is connected to so many communities without one restaurant serving healthy food and connected to actual companies selling products with chemicals in them that contribute to illness.
Yeah,
we need
absolutely.
To start going towards creating environmental awareness for all of us for a wide range of reasons.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really two different conversations, what causes cancer and what heals it, because there are some people that I interviewed who are convinced that their emotional world caused their cancer, and there are other people who are convinced that the pesticides on their lawn caused their cancer. Regardless of the cause that people, and I did ask people at the end, you know, do you have any thoughts about what caused your cancer? And I got a whole range of answers. But I got commonalities in terms of how they treated their cancer. And 7 of those 9 treatments or factors, healing factors, were mental and emotional. And again, that just goes back to this idea that we're not necessarily linking the cure to the cause. We're saying something is broken down in the body. What are all the tools we can use to fix it? And across the board, the people that I studied did use emotional things to help fix their immune system. And that includes things like releasing suppressed emotions. So if you're holding on to any emotion, whether it's fear, stress, resentment, sadness, even holding on to happiness, if you hold on to it, it very quickly turns into nostalgia.
That's interesting.
Because then you're suddenly holding on to happiness of something that happened in the past, right? And so the people that I study really worked on releasing any emotion that was being held in their body, in their mind, and therefore in their body. And they released it in a number of different ways. You know, some of them released it through therapy, other people through, you know, energy medicine like acupuncture, Reiki, or body talk. Other people released it through journaling, you know, having fire ceremonies and burning old letters or old photos. But, you know, when you talk about was there a common personality, there wasn't a common personality of the people I studied. There were common actions that they took. And releasing suppressed emotions, making time every day to make sure that you have at least 5 minutes of joy every day, that was a commonality for sure. You know, the days when they were most afraid of leaving their children behind and were just crying all day, even on those days, they took a five-minute YouTube break or a five-minute, you know, call to their friend who would crack a joke or cheer them up. The common thread of all of these 9 factors is that they directly or indirectly strengthen the immune system. And there are scientific studies done by other people, not by me, on each of these factors. And I mentioned these studies in the book. So, you know, can we guarantee that if you do these 9 things, you'll cure your cancer? We can't guarantee that. It'll take about 50 years of clinical trials for us to prove that. But what we already know from other proven studies is that individually these 9 things directly or indirectly strengthen your immune system. And that's what we need in order to be healthy from any disease.
You've been listening to Zentertainment Talk Radio on the web at www.zentertainment.org. My name is Joe Davidson. Thank you so much for joining me. That was Dr. Kelly Turner. You can find out more about her great new book at radicalremission.com. Have a good week, and I will talk to you next time. Peace.